Coming to you from a secret satellite base in geosynchronous orbit, 22,300 miles above the surface of the Earth, this is the second Long Box Graveyard Podcast. My name is Paul O'Connor, and for the next half of an hour or so, I will catch you up on what is happening at my Long Box Graveyard blog, and also bring you this month's feature, which is The Ritual. Thanks for listening, and whether you're a new listener or joining me for the second time this month, I'm glad that you are here. The numbers are in from last month's podcast, and they're good. Or at least I think they're good. I have no basis for comparison. This is only my second podcast, meaning last month's recording was my first podcast. But to judge by the generous comments I've received on Twitter and elsewhere, it seems I did okay. So I'm back again and trying to improve as we go forward. So, those numbers. According to Mo Christensen at We Talk Podcasts, and it is Mo who puts the show together. Thanks, Mo. In the first week, this podcast had 802 views, with 218 of them being unique visitors and 393 downloads, which Mo assures me is a good showing for a new podcast. Thank you if you were one of those downloads, and if you weren't, remember you can still go back and listen to my inaugural Long Box Graveyard podcast, where I detail my secret origin and discuss the importance of childish things. For those of you joining me for the first time, Long Box Graveyard is my weekly comic book blog, where I look at Bronze and Silver Age comics from the late 60s through the early 90s. The blog is published every Wednesday at www.longboxgraveyard.com, and I carry on a pretty much daily Twitter conversation with fans all over the world, courtesy of my Twitter account, which is at LBoxGraveyard. Hopefully you're already reading the blog and following me on Twitter. If not, please jump aboard and let's get to know each other. Speaking of the Long Box Graveyard blog, here's a rundown of what you can expect to see there in the month ahead. Remember, a new blog is published every Wednesday at www.longboxgraveyard.com. On Wednesday, July 18th, I will preview Batman, the Gray Knight. Now, I call him Gray because this review looks at the transitional and largely forgotten time in Batman's history, the five-year run on Batman and Detective Comics from the early 1980s. By writer Doug Mensch, primarily penciled by Gene Colan and Don Newton. It is an interesting time for Batman. It's really the last of the Bronze Age Batman, before the twin thunderbolts of Crisis on Infinite Earths and especially Frank Miller's Dark Knight Returns changed Batman and comics forever. I'll look at what made Batman different in those days, about how Batman sometimes seemed like his job, how he might crack a smile every now and then, and how he seemed to take joy in his relationship with Jason Todd. And I'll render my verdict on which Batman I prefer, the old or the new, and the verdict might surprise you. Wednesday, July 25th, was to be my San Diego Comic-Con wrap-up, but I'm reconsidering that now. I'm not sure the show is worth a full column of the blog. I may just cover the show with a small aside and run a panel gallery in its place. At this hour, I'm still debating, so tune in on the 25th for my mystery column. Wednesday, August 1st will bring you a rarity, my review of War of the Worlds from Marvel's Amazing Adventures back in the early 1970s. This is the Killraven story, about a ragtag human resistance to Martian invaders. It gets very artsy and very peculiar when the signature team of Don McGregor and P. Craig Russell take over the book. I think the series is a little diamond in the rough. It's artistic and ambitious and experimental, but it's still a mainstream Marvel book from what I feel is the most creative era that company's ever enjoyed, except, of course, for the original Stan Lee, Jack Kirby, Steve Ditko, Silver Age heyday. These Amazing Adventures are amazing comics, and they're still very affordable on the back issue market, so join me on the 1st of August to learn more about Killraven and Amazing Adventures and to determine if you should add these books to your collection. That same day, over at StashMyComics.com, the third installment of my Dollar Box column should go live. This looks at issue number 3 of the original Silver Surfer run, The Power and the Prize, where the Surfer and Mephisto, in his first appearance, slug it out in the depths of hell in a battle over love and lost souls. It's a Stan Lee, John Buscema classic, and it's my favorite Silver Surfer story. So join me for that column, and I'll tell you why. Finally, on Wednesday, August 8th, I'll be doing my digital comics rant. This was originally published last spring at the We Talk Comics website. Excuse me. I have updated my rant to account for changes in the business since then, and this column will set the stage for a couple August columns I'm planning, including my review of the Born Digital DC original Batman series, Legends of the Dark Knight, which will receive a full review later that month, as well as the first installment of, the third installment, of this Longbox Graveyard podcast, which will concern digital comics. And I hope to have that ready for you on August 14th, the third Tuesday of the month, which is always go time for the Longbox Graveyard podcast. But that's all in the future. Right now, it's time for this month's feature, The Ritual. This month's feature is called The Ritual, and it's about Comic-Cons, sort of. It's about the San Diego Comic-Con specifically, but really more about conventions and gatherings and the rituals of fan behavior, why we do what we do. As I record this podcast, the 2012 edition of the world-famous San Diego Comic-Con is in full swing. It's Friday night. I'm sure there are parties all over the gas lamp right now. It was hopping when I was down there Thursday night, and I'm sure it's bedlam right now. I'm not at any of those parties. I don't like parties. I've never liked parties. I'd really much rather be here with you guys, doing a podcast or blogging. I don't like big crowded places much. But I still go to Comic-Con every year, which is about as crowded a place as you can imagine. Why do I do this? I was at Comic-Con yesterday, and it was like most other years at Comic-Con. Crowded and increasingly shrill. My time on the dealer's floor was limited, but in that time it seemed to me there were fewer back issue dealers than last year. Maybe we lost a row or something. I spent the better part of the morning prowling for titles on my wish list, but came home with an empty sack. I don't know if this is down to getting picky, or a narrowing selection, or just my simple refusal to pay for issues that are marked up three times what they're worth, even if they're then discounted by 50%. I didn't even have any luck tracking down the graphic novels that I wanted. I found a few, but I'm not going to pay full boat at a convention when Amazon offers the same stock online for a discount. I'll happily pay retail at a groovy shop like the House of Secrets in Burbank, California. I want to support good retailers when I can, but at a show I think it's up to the retailer to attract my business and with discounts or stock that I can't get elsewhere. I didn't explore much of the rest of the floor. It was predictably loud and crowded down at the media end of the hall, and I just bounced off the side of that. I'm not into the movie booths or the video game stuff or the toy booths, though I will have to hack my way to a few of those places if I return to the show on Sunday with my son Jack. I give the big movie presentations in Hall H and Ballroom 20 such a wide berth that they might as well not even exist. I was really only too happy to quit the floor with my dignity and my wallet intact. And I would have come home with my bag entirely empty if I hadn't bought a cheesy comic book lanyard and a Captain America keychain at the little souvenir stand outside the art area, the art show area. I happened upon that while heading up to my panel in room 32AB. That's right. I hosted a panel at Comic-Con, put on the Malibu Comics retrospective on Thursday, assembling Malibu co-founders Scott Rosenberg, Dave Ulbrich, Tom Mason, and Chris Holm to discuss the legacy of Malibu, including the Ultraverse and the Image Comics launch. It went well enough, and we had a fair crowd, and it was fun for the guys to get together and reminisce. But in hindsight, I tried to fit too much into our hour, and the back half of the talk was truncated. And while we did continue the talk out in the hall, I didn't get the chance to ask as much about the later days of Malibu as I would have liked. You know, there's lots of material there. Maybe we'll do another panel at a later date. For now, I'm happy to cross having hosted a Comic-Con panel off my bucket list. I do appreciate the guys for consenting to the panel, and it was nice to see friends there, including Horace Austin and Keith Kalbeck, both of whom are friends of my blog and listeners of this podcast. Thanks, guys. But aside from seeing friends and striking a blow for actual comic book content at the San Diego Comic-Con, I frankly could have done without the show this year. I'm about to sound like a total jerk, if I'm not already. by saying that I'm pretty much over San Diego Comic-Con. I'm ready to move on, and I will happily leave this particular show behind. For me, it has become too loud, too strident, too overproduced, too commercial, really. I just feel buffeted and weary after a day in that place, and it's harder and harder to justify the time and expense and hassle of fighting my way through these crowds for largely the same experience year after year. Now, complaining about Comic-Con has to rank right at the top of the list of trivial first world problems. I understand how entitled this seems, even as I say the words. But this is a comic book podcast, so a certain level of triviality and entitlement is acceptable. Maybe it's even required. Even on a comics podcast, though, I'm not expecting sympathy for these views. Most fans would rightly consider a trip to San Diego Comic-Con as the experience of a lifetime, and they don't want to hear me complain about the hardship of going every year, and going for free at that. But, you know, that's part of the problem. I've been going to Comic-Con for decades now, and it's pretty much been a yearly event for my family and me since we moved to the San Diego area in 2002. Thanks to the comic book work I did in the 1990s, and then by the video game work I've done ever since, the con committee has smiled favorably upon my pro status, and they have generously afforded me a free badge every year I've attended the con. That consideration has also been extended to my wife and two kids, though this year they put a little squeeze on me and reduced the number of free guest badges I could claim. This is a good thing. I am at best a marginal pro, and aside from cramming my family into the crowd on the show floor and spending some money, I've contributed very little to the show. This year, sure, I put on a panel and I deserve my free admission, but these past several years, it's been nuts, just nuts, to let marginal pros such as myself into the show for free. Especially when there are so many paying customers who have been unable to get a badge for the con. I mean, admission sold out in like 15 minutes this year. I think Comic-Con should grandfather in everyone who's won an Eisner or been in the business more than 15 years or, you know, whatever, and then start charging everyone else who wants to attend. And even if they don't go to that length, they should definitely continue squeezing the number of guest passes afforded to pros. The reason they need to do this is the crowding, which is only getting worse. The lineups for the big media panels at Comic-Con are ridiculous. They last hours or even days. And just trying to move around on the show floor is an epic undertaking. A sluggish human sea that clogs up the aisles and is so thick at times that I genuinely worry if there's an emergency. What if there's a fire or an earthquake or someone drops a box of Twinkies or something and sets off a stampede? I'm more than half serious that I'm afraid people are going to be killed on that show floor. Even the prospect of some poor soul suffering a heart attack out there is frightening. And not so unlikely, with the close quarters and the heat and the stress and the pushing and the shoving. I mean, I could totally see someone's ticker packing it in like Tony Stark and needing assistance. And I wouldn't want to bet on the chances of getting a fast evacuation on that floor, particularly if there's a phalanx of Princess Leia's showing their legs in the aisleway for fanboys to photograph, or maybe some big movie star like Ernie Hudson is there, or that guy from that movie. And, you know, they're selling their autographs where the meat wagon needs to get through. I'm making light of it, but the floor is thick, and it's too crowded, and it's really not fun, and I think it's dangerous. I'm not a lawyer, and I don't know fire codes. I'm just a loudmouth of the comics podcast, but I can't imagine that exhibit floor is compliant with fire codes. There are no turnstiles counting off the bodies as they go in and out, so the best they can do is estimate the crowd. And say the code says you can have X thousand guys on the floor at once. Well, if the average comics fan is, say, 10% larger than the average human being, and the floor is at capacity, then isn't it already 10% over capacity? And then you mix in the double-wide strollers and the huge guys with the belly wheels and the dude in the angel suit with the wings that spread out over two aisles and the guy in the life-size Galactus costume, and you're telling me it's safe out there? I'm not buying it. It's dangerous. It's a zoo. It's too crowded. It's too expensive. Too much of a hassle to get down to the show every year, but God help me, I still go. And so do 130,000 of my closest geek friends. And many more would take our places if they could get a badge. It's loud and practically impossible to get in to see the things you really want to see. So why do we continue to do it? Or at least why do I continue to do it? I think it's kind of a ritual. Set aside the people that like the con just the way it is. There are certainly plenty of them who don't think it's a problem. And they would be aghast at my suggestion that the con committee double prices and also dealer's fees in an effort to reduce the crowds and improve the experience for those that remain after they shake out the riffraff, including marginal pros like me. Seriously, charge people more. They'll enjoy the show more. It's counterintuitive, but you will find it is true. When Disneyland raised prices a couple years ago, there was a lot of griping, but customer satisfaction surveys showed that attendees actually enjoyed their trips more because crowds were down, they could move around and get on more rides. And Disney made more money, not only from admissions, but also from happier customers that were more likely to open their wallets for souvenirs and food. So that should inspire retailers that maybe have to pay more for their booth space. But if we have fewer retailers, we got wider aisles, and that also helps reduce the congestion. If you're worried about pricing fans out of the show, then set aside a lottery for hardship tickets that are free or reduced. I mean, you already have a lottery system in place for tickets right now, so that shouldn't be so hard to arrange. But, you know, that's another show, and Comic-Con isn't going to change or listen to me anyway, so let me get back to the point, which is that even setting aside those people who like the crowds and the spectacle, and, you know, the movie studios that like having people line up for their movie stars to create buzz for their crazy movies. You know, everybody shouts woo every time the starlet giggles or drops a double entendre. Even outside of the people who like Comic-Con, just fine, thank you. There are plenty of people who feel compelled to go, even when it runs contrary to their every instinct, who go even as they complain about it and roll their eyes and wonder why are they doing it again when they swore that this was it, never again. And then here they are plunging back into the craziness again. Well, I think it's a ritual. There's certainly no other way to explain Camp Twilight, the lovely Twihards who started lining up for the last Twilight panel that kicked off the show on Thursday morning, with a line that started forming days, nights earlier. Now, there's legitimate scarcity here. You know, this is the last film in the Twilight franchise, and this is likely the only chance that the average taxpayer can crowd into a hall and shout woo when their heroes come on stage. And that's great that they want to do that. I mean, I write a comic book blog. I'm in a big glass booth. I don't throw rocks at anybody. But lining up for days? Really? Okay. For that matter, you know, lining up for midnight showings of a movie when it comes out? Movie's just a recorded performance showing on thousands of screens. There's no hint of scarcity whatsoever. But folks will still line up to be first, to be with the crowd. Why do they do that? Why did I do it for Avengers? I think it's a ritual. You know, the idea of a wide opening for movies is a pretty recent phenomenon. It's only been in the last 30 years or so, in the era of multiplexes, that movies have gone for that big opening weekend, playing on 3,000 screens across the country, maximizing their marketing spend with a big splashy opening, and then riding that opening for weekend after weekend until the movie completed its run. It used to be that movies were platform releases, opened in a few cities at a time, gradually expanding as audience demand dictated. It might take weeks or months for a movie to come to your town after opening in New York or Los Angeles, and you could expect a nice long run for the better pictures too, as there was little pressure to clear screens for the next big event, or to hustle a movie out of the theaters in time for home video release. I mean, there was no such thing as home video. So there was some genuine scarcity when a movie like Star Wars or Close Encounters of the Third Kind or E.T. or Alien first opened, and I stood in line to see all those movies. Sometimes for a couple hours. I stood in line all day for Close Encounters. Didn't like it much, but, you know, it was fun to do that with my friends, I suppose. I was just a teen, didn't have a lot of better things to do, but even then, I had a sense that we were paying a kind of respect, going through this ritual of lining up for a movie and toughing out the line as a way of expressing our extraordinary allegiance to these movies of ours, something that set us apart from the regular public that thought, yeah, sure, it's a movie, it's cool, what's next? You know, for us, it was an event that seemed more important and more exciting for the ritual affection we invested in it by lining up early and wearing our spray-painted black motorcycle Darth Vader helmets to the Empire Strikes Back. Yeah, we had cosplay before there was a name for it. The thing is, there's precious little opportunity for this kind of virtual celebration in today's era of geek plenty. The comic book business has long attempted to create artificial scarcity with variant covers, polybag books, or the bullet hole covers that my buddies at Malibu Comics pioneered. Everything you can imagine. But it's just that. It's artificial scarcity. When someone sells you a new object as a collector's item, your antenna needs to go up, son. The only thing being collected is your wallet. A Golden Age comic book that survived 7 decades in your grandmother's attic, that wasn't used as a coloring book or cut up by some crazy kid, that wasn't rained on or pulped in a wartime paper drive, that, you know, features a genuine piece of Americana like Superman or Wonder Woman or Batman, or even a Silver Age treasure like the first Fantastic Four or Spider-Man comics, those are genuinely scarce, and they are rightfully prized by collectors as cultural artifacts. But some variant cover of a rebooted superhero comic, it's not collectible, unless you can be made to believe it is. Print runs can be limited to create scarcity, but it's artificial scarcity, just like it is artificial to believe that the midnight showing of Avengers that I attended was somehow more special, because it was part of an all-day Marvel movie marathon. And I suppose it was, because I still have fond memories from that day. It was special and different to sit in the theater all day long, but it was a manufactured event, and not really the same thing as standing in line around the block outside the Chinese theater in 1977 to see Star Wars, when there really were a limited number of prints and the movie was only showing a few places in the city. It is in manufacturing a big, bubbling, pop culture volcano for this ritual sacrifice of fanish affection, where I think events like the San Diego Comic-Con are still unique. It is an artificial event, but in the sum of its parts, it is unique, and genuinely scarce and authentic, even if the crap you buy there is the same stuff you can find at the corner store or on the net, and even if the exclusive movie clips debuted at the show appear on YouTube within hours of the event. Riding home from the show last night, bleary-eyed and with my feet throbbing, I tried to isolate why I continue to go to the show. And a lot of things came to mind. That I was chasing my youth by trying to live up to some past ideal of fan behavior. That I needed to surrender my own overdeveloped ego to the idea of something larger. That I needed to validate my obsessions with these kinds of over-the-top displays. That I just needed to be among my own kind in a community of like-minded geeks. And those things are all true, but they were more true in the past, and they didn't have as much of a hold on me this year. This year, those ideas seem to be losing their grip, and I realized why. It's because of this podcast. It's because of Long Box Graveyard, my blog, my podcast, my Twitter conversation, the community I've discovered through the Long Box Graveyard project. My blog has become my new ritual. It's a smaller devotion than Comic-Con, but it's a devotion I get to make every week. And it kind of bleeds off the steam, satisfying my needs and making a pilgrimage to Comic-Con seem a bit less urgent. So, too, I can better control my ritual through my own blog, setting my own publishing schedule, deciding what I will cover, and being perfectly free to walk away from the whole thing if that's what I want to do. Long Box Graveyard is every bit as much a ritual as the San Diego Comic-Con. It's every bit as artificial, every bit as manufactured, and every bit as much an over-the-top demonstration of slavish fan devotion. Believe me, I devote dozens of hours a week to this thing, and it's not because anyone asked me to do it, or because the blog makes money. I mean, it doesn't. It's quite the opposite. I do it because I need to surrender my overdeveloped ego to something larger. To validate my obsessions with over-the-top displays, to be among my own kind in a community of like-minded geeks. All the same reasons I feel the need to go to Comic-Con. But I have to say, it's so much more rewarding and fulfilling for me to scratch that itch with you here on my podcast and at my blog than it is to shove my way into the San Diego Convention Center and be a face in the crowd shouting, "Woo!" at a panel for some third-rate sci-fi channel television show. Of course, Long Box Graveyard is infinitesimally smaller and less significant than San Diego Comic-Con. It's not a patch on the pop culture phenomenon that is that show. But you know what? It's all mine. And it's yours, too. It's my ritual. I hope it becomes a part of your ritual. I don't think I can swear off Comic-Con entirely. Even if I'm done with the show, I don't think the show is done with me. But if I do end up going back, at least it will be with my eyes open and with an understanding of what I am doing and why I am doing it. It's my ritual. Is it yours? Let me know your thoughts. I'll give you contact information at the end of the show. And thanks for being part of my ritual. Plug of the month. This month's plug is for MarsWillSendNoMore.com. This very, very unique and fun blog is the brainchild of Matthew Camp. He's a genuine comic book lover, and he shares his enthusiasm with scanned pages of out-of-print books from his collection. It's an eclectic site, and the content is driven by Matthew's whims, but some of the things you'll find there are dinosaurs, Alex Nino, dinosaurs, cosmic characters like Galactus and Thanos, dinosaurs, classic science fiction stories, and dinosaurs. Did I mention dinosaurs? Matthew, or Mars, as I prefer to call him, is a good guy, and one of the pleasures of running Longbox Graveyard has been meeting people like him. It would make me very happy indeed if I helped you to discover his site, where I've also done a little bit of writing with Mars, most notably the March Madness T-Rex beatdown the two of us did in the spring, where we matched the greatest and most fearsome T-Rexes of comics and movies against each other in an elimination tournament battle to the death. Again, the name of the site is Mars Will Send No More at www.marswillsendnomore.com. And yes, that is an enigmatic name for a website, but I'll leave it to you to discover the significance of that name by mousing over to the site for yourself. It's just one of many surprises awaiting you at Mars' site, along with a whole heck of a lot of dinosaurs. MarsWillSendNoMore.com. Please check it out, and tell Mars I sent you. Now, where to find me? Just like that, we're at the end of another podcast. Thanks again for listening. Please tell your friends about Longbox Graveyard and this podcast. And please tell me what you think of the podcast. You can find me in all the usual places. Not Comic-Con, but all the usual places. You can search for Longbox Graveyard on Google, or on Google Plus, or on Facebook. Or you can follow me on Twitter, at LBox Graveyard on Twitter. You can also email me at longboxgraveyard@gmail.com. And you can, of course, always find me at www.longboxgraveyard.com. where a new blog is published every Wednesday. We're at the end. Thanks again for listening. Thanks again to the indispensable Mo Christensen and the guys at We Talk Podcast for hosting this show. And thanks to all my many readers and followers for supporting my efforts and my rituals at Longbox Graveyard. I will see you again in August with a new show all about digital comics, unless I change my mind, as well as news and other surprises. For now, this is Paul O'Connor of the Longbox Graveyard Podcast signing off, and I'll see you in the funny papers.
heard love, sister, just a kiss away.
Germany, it's like you gotta work for it, but you really get it.